I am still Cliff Haka, Director of Libraries. Now I'm back to introduce our series. So first of all, thank you very much for getting out here. I know that this has been the kind of couple of months it's getting to be, and kind of evening that can discourage participation, but we're very pleased that all of you both have signed up for this and made the effort to get here on this very difficult night. The library is always happy to be a nexus point for a variety of activities, and I think this is just a great one, a great opportunity to bring people together around important topics. And the only thing I think about events like this is I wish we had more of them. So thank you for being a part of that. So we mostly I am up here to thank many people and that, or organizations, and that of course starts with the National Endowment for the Humanities and the American Library Association that provided grant money so that the MSU libraries could host this five-part reading and discussion series called Let's Talk About It, Muslim Journeys. So as you well know, you'll be reading five books and discussing them, and what could be more appropriate or closer to the heart of librarians. So I'm really glad that we can play a small part in facilitating this, and I certainly want to thank the library staff that because I'm up here talking, I had very little to do other than say, well, that's a good idea, why don't you do that? So Deb Margolis of our staff was the lead on that, but many others have played a part, and so thanks to them. So I'd also like to mention and thank our campus partners, MSU Muslim Studies Program, and Dr. Muhammad Khali, the interim director, who will also be the scholar leading this. And he is a FINCE Award, was given the FINCE Award for Teaching Excellence in the Arts and Humanities, and we're very happy to have him leading this and think it'll be a wonderful experience for you to interact with him. We would also like to thank the Honors College and the Department of Anthropology that have been partners in this. We also have some community partners, the East Lansing Area Clergy Association, represented, if she is here, by Catherine Burt. Thank you so much for the support of your organization. The Islamic Society of Greater Lansing, represented by Thasen Sader. Thank you very much. The Michigan Humanities Council, which would have been represented tonight by Eric Nordberg, and who will probably be along for subsequent sessions, but they had a family, I think it was a pet situation, but pets can be just about part of the family. And we'd also like to thank two of our library partners, the East Lansing Public Library and the Capital Area District Library. So again, thanks to all of you, thanks to all of our partners and the people who have made this possible. I hope you have a wonderful experience, and we're just happy to provide the physical setting. So since you didn't come here to hear me talk tonight, welcome to the libraries, welcome to the program, and I will turn it over to Deborah.
Thanks a lot, Cliff. Thank you, everyone, for being here. Welcome. It's great to see you all. I've probably corresponded with you on email, most of you. Some of you just heard about it just now, so it's great to have you here. Please bear with me as I provide a little background on the project, tell you how the evening will proceed, and give you some guidelines for discussion, and also introduce you to some people here tonight. So we're one of 125 libraries in the U.S. who were awarded this grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities to host this programming, and the main goal of the discussion series is to engage communities in learning about Islam, Muslims, and Islamic civilizations. The Muslim Journeys Bookshelf is a group of 25 books and 3 DVDs that were chosen by this national project, and we have those books at the library here. We have them at the East Lansing Public Library and Capital Area District Library, Okemos. So the books were chosen by the national project, but here at MSU we chose to focus on this Pathways of Faith theme. And we're very lucky to be guided in this by our project scholar, Dr. Muhammad Khalil. The Let's Talk About It reading and discussion model has been run in libraries for about 30 years, and it encourages thoughtful, respectful discussion based on common readings. So we're going to begin the evening with a short lecture from Dr. Khalil, and then we're going to break into groups for discussion. We're going to spend about 45 minutes in the discussion groups, and using the questions provided on your handout there, on one side you've got lecture notes from the beginning of the evening, and then on the other side are the discussion questions. And then after, so we're gonna break into groups and after Dr. Khalil's lecture, I'll tell you how we're going to break into groups. But after the discussion groups, please gather back here, and we're going to hear more from Dr. Khalil and kind of summarize. So again, we're so happy that you're here to, that you've made this commitment to reading these books, and also you made this commitment to learning from each other. Whatever our age or background, we have something to contribute to the discussion of the book and to the topic at hand. And these are just some guidelines for discussion. You know, during the discussion period, please listen to others and give everyone a chance to speak if they want to speak. And please don't feel that you need to be the representative of your religion or culture or some other group, and also don't expect others to act as the representative of their community or faith, you know, unless they want to, of course. We do have a pretty large group here, and the way we're going to run the discussion portion is that we are really grateful to have a group of MSU graduate students with an interest in Muslim studies who are going to lead those discussion groups. And so I know that you're going to really benefit from getting to know them. And so I'm just going to introduce them briefly, and just they're going to kind of raise their hand. Ebru Aaron Webb is a PhD student in the political science department, and there's Ebru. I think James may still be on his way because he's coming from a class, right? I don't see James yet. But so James Wright is a first-year PhD student in the College of Education. You'll meet James later. Jihan Abdullah Muhammad is a first-year PhD student in sociology. She's right there. Adrienne Tyree is a third-year PhD student in history. There's Adrienne. And then Sonia Javid Sheikh is a graduate student in the Department of Communications. And she's also, so we've got three of us. So yeah, everybody's actually right there. And then James will be joining us. the way we're going to divide into groups, I mean, don't worry about this too much right now, but some of you have a colored dot on your name tag. And those of you who have the color dots will move to one of three discussion areas in the back of the room, and they're marked with the paper back there. But, you know, we can help you when it's time to do that. And if for some reason you don't want to move, you know, you don't have to move, okay? And if any of you might have a concern about hearing issues or hearing each other, you might want to move to one of the two sort of contained discussion rooms. So you should feel free to join those if you want. We have several library staff members who are here to assist at any point, so I just wanted them to raise their hands. We have Kayla, a student employee here, Mary Jo Zeter, one of our librarians. We've got Rick Pfeiffer and JC, student, and they're helping with some of the AV and the facilities. Chris DeFord is here as well, and she probably checked you in out there. So anytime you need something, just ask me or one of them. So finally, sorry about that. It's my honor to introduce Muhammad Khalil. Muhammad Hassan Khalil is Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Michigan State, and he's an adjunct professor in the College of Law and the Interim Director of the Muslim Studies Program. Before returning to his hometown of East Lansing, he was Assistant Professor of Religion and Visiting Professor of Law at the University of Illinois. He specializes in Islamic thought and is author of Islam and the Fate of Others, The Salvation Question, which was published in 2012 by Oxford University Press, and editor of Between Heaven and Hell, Islam, Salvation, and the Fate of Others, also Oxford University Press from last year. And I'll turn over to Muhammad.
Good evening. First, I'd like to thank MSU Libraries and many co-sponsors. And in particular, I'd like to thank Deborah Margolis. I think she's been working on this for over a year now, I think. And she's been working tirelessly. So please join me in thanking Deborah Margolis. This lecture will be relatively brief, relatively basic, and hopefully in our discussions and in subsequent lectures, we'll delve into more advanced topics. But we begin Let's start at the beginning, right, as Maria von Trapp says. Okay, so let's begin with the traditional Muslim greeting. And I'm going to begin every lecture with this greeting. And it is, Assalamu alaikum. Can you all say, Assalamu alaikum? And I want to make sure everyone who attends this can pronounce it the right way. So let's try it one more time. Assalamu, and you're going to go back deep in here. Alaikum, you know that ah sound, like Pee Wee Herman, right? Ha-ha, right? Back there. So one more time. Assalamu alaikum. Much better. What does it mean? It means, literally, it's peace be upon you. You could think of it as peace be with you. And the short version of that is salam, which just means peace. Which, by the way, is a lot like a Hebrew word you might know. Shalom, which also means peace. Arabic and Hebrew are Semitic languages. They belong to a body of languages called the Semitic languages. Okay, so salamu alaikum, the response to assalamu alaikum is wa alaikum assalam. And it just means, and upon you be peace. So can you all say, wa alaikum assalam? All right, very nice. So let's begin with some general information. The term Islam, what does it mean? You know, after 9/11, it was very common to see Muslims on television and in print and so on, saying that Islam means peace. Islam means peace. And technically, that's true. The word Islam does technically mean peace. But the primary meaning of Islam in the context of the religion is submission or surrender. And it's submission or surrender to God. Now, these terms, submission and surrender, often have a negative connotation. But here it has a very positive connotation in the Muslim view, because it's you are submitting to your Creator, not to any human being. Okay, so Islam is submission to God. A Muslim, then, is one who submits. A Muslim is one who submits or surrenders to God. Which is why the Quran refers to Abraham as a Muslim. He was not following the Prophet Muhammad. He was submitting to God. And that's why there's this widespread belief that everybody is born a Muslim, because everybody is born in a state of submission. Okay. The population of Muslims worldwide, you hear so many estimates out there, let's say 1.6 billion and growing. And you'll notice the next point in the notes, it reads, the many faces of Islam. What percentage, now if you know the answer, don't say anything, but what percentage of Muslims would you say are Arab? So
less than half.
Less than half, okay. 20%. And actually, most have it between 13 and 20%. So that means that most Muslims are not Arab. Furthermore, not all Arabs are Muslim. There are many Arab Christians and Arab Jews, Yemeni Jews, Iraqi Jews, and so on. Now, the next term we see on the list, oh, and by the way, what's the country with the largest Muslim population? Indonesia. Indonesia. Not Saudi Arabia, not Egypt. Indonesia, in the Far East. Number two, Pakistan. And by the way, it looks like Pakistan might be number one in a few decades. Number three, India. Even though India is majority Hindu, there are more Muslims in India than in any Arab country. Number four, Bangladesh. Bangladesh is the fourth largest Muslim population. So we're not even in the Arab world yet. If you look at the top four, they're all in East Asia, South Asia. Okay. All right. The next term we see is Allah. What does Allah mean? Just as there were Muslims after 9/11 saying Islam means peace, Islam means peace, after 9/11 there were people saying Allah is some kind of Arabian pagan something. There were different answers given. Moon goddess or person, I mean, different answers were given. And this is odd. Allah is simply the Arabic word for God. It is simply the Arabic word for God. If you walk into a church in Egypt, you pick up one of the Bibles, you'll go to Genesis 1, you will read, if you can read Arabic, I'm not trying to rub it in, but if you read Arabic, you'll see, فِي الْبَدْءِ خَلَقَ اللَّهُ السَّمَوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ. In the beginning, God created the heavens and earth, and the word for God is Allah. And you go to the New Testament, same thing. Jesus is talking about Allah. In languages related to Arabic, you see similar terms. We said Hebrew is a Semitic language. One way you can say God in Hebrew is Elohim. Elohim. And if you know Hebrew, you know that the im at the end of Elohim magnifies. So just listen to that, Elohim. And then when you look at other languages that are Semitic, what language did Jesus reportedly speak? Aramaic. And how do you say God in Aramaic? Well, one way is Elaha. In fact, if you watch Mel Gibson's controversial film, The Passion of the Christ, there's a scene, and I think it's The Last Supper, but don't quote me on that. There's a scene where Jesus says Elaha, and it's translated as God. And if you know Arabic, you know that, I'm not trying to be obnoxious, but in Arabic, one way you could actually say Allaha, depending on where it is in the sentence. If you want to say, I love God, you would say, Uhibbu Allaha. So just listen to this. Allaha, Elaha. Allaha, Elaha. They're almost the same. So Allah, again, is simply the Arabic word for God. You know, I was at a conference in Jordan almost a decade ago, and there was an Arab priest who was presenting at this academic conference. He himself was an academic and a priest. And he made this point, and he said, I don't understand why in America there's so much confusion about Allah. We know it's just the Arabic word for God. And he was baffled by this. Okay. The next term is the Quran, or Quran. Now, you're probably wondering, why do we see different spellings for Quran? We see Quran, Quran, and actually for Muslim also, Muslim, Muslim. For a long time, people used the Turkish pronunciation because of the Ottoman Empire and the Ottoman influence, and then later the Turkish influence. So often in Europe and then later in America, people would use the Turkish pronunciation, so Muslim instead of the Arabic Muslim, and Quran instead of Quran. So the Quran is the Islamic holy book. It is believed to be the word of God, as the reading makes very clear. And I'm going to save my comments on the Quran for our lecture on the Quran, for our discussion of the Quran. The person who transmits the Quran is the Prophet Muhammad. Now, you should know that the Prophet Muhammad is considered one of many prophets. And all of the prophets are revered. Okay, actually, I'll get to that point in just a moment. But it's very common for Muslims to say, when they simply hear the name Muhammad, or if they're reading the name, they'll say something like, peace be upon him or them, if you're referring to the prophets. At least once they might say it, maybe aloud or maybe silently. And some people will say it each time, every single time the name is mentioned, as a sign of respect. And this applies to the other prophets. Jesus and Moses, as we'll see. Muhammad was, again, I'll save my comments about his life for actually next week, because next week we're reading a book about him. Okay. Now, according to popular belief, Abraham has two sons, two well-known sons, Ismail in Arabic, and Isaac, Ishaq in Arabic. Ishmael is widely considered the ancestor of the Arabs, and this includes Muhammad. The author of the text notes that it's not necessarily the case that Muhammad believed himself to be a descendant of Ishmael. He may or may not have been, may or may not have thought of himself as a descendant. Whatever the case may be, certainly that is the widespread belief among Muslims as well, that he is indeed a descendant of Ishmael. Furthermore, Abraham has another son named Isaac, and Isaac has Jacob, also known as Israel, and Jacob has Joseph, and down the line you go, you get to Moses, and then down the line you go, you get to Jesus. Now, these are all, everyone you see listed here is significant in the Quran, in the Islamic holy book. Who knows what is the most often mentioned name in the Quran? That's right, Moses. Now Muhammad. Muhammad only appears four times. He's addressed throughout the text, but his name appears only four times, and a variant of his name, Ahmed, appears once. But Moses is the most often mentioned name in the Quran. And, you know, he's a hero in the Quran. And the most often mentioned nemesis, or bad guy, you could say, is Pharaoh. And as someone of Egyptian lineage, I don't know how I feel about that. In all seriousness, Pharaoh is the ultimate bad guy in the Quran. And of course, Jesus is revered in the Quran. but presented as a human being, not as God, not as the Son of God, but simply a human being, a prophet. And the same is true for Muhammad. Muhammad is not seen as divine in any way. I've seen people claim, oh, in Islam, Allah is Muhammad. No. Muhammad is seen as just a human being. In fact, if a Muslim were to claim that Muhammad is divine, that person would probably not be considered a Muslim by the vast majority of Muslims. Okay. Now, in the holy book, as I mentioned before, is the Quran. And the Quran allows Muslims to appreciate or get a sense of Sharia. Now, here's a term we hear often in the news, Sharia law. This country is going to implement Sharia law, dun, dun, dun. And there's this, you know, it's a very negative thing, right? The scary Sharia law. What's interesting is that Muslims disagree on what Sharia law entails. So first of all, what does the term Sharia mean? Sharia is the path that leads you to the water hole. Imagine you're in a desert, and this is the path that leads you to the source of water, right? Sharia is the path you are to take. And the idea here is that Sharia is the law, the way that God wants people to live. The law that God wants of us, that God wants us to implement. And also the code of ethics God wants us to implement or to recognize. And because none of us are infallible, Muslims have long recognized that it's okay if we disagree on a variety of issues, because no one here is infallible. In the fourth Islamic century, there was a Muslim scholar, who compiled a list of all the doctrines Muslims agree on, and it was a slim volume, published today, 166 pages. Same century, another scholar compiles a list of all the doctrines they disagree on, a voluminous work. And I'm sure if you were to do the same thing today, you would, the things they agree on would be a very slim volume. And what they disagree on, I mean, they'd probably keep working on that until they die. But that's not to say that there aren't significant things that they agree on. And that takes us to the next point, the five pillars of Islam. Sunnis and Shiites, the two major sects of Islam, and others even. The Ibadis, for example, a small sect that you'll find in Oman and elsewhere. They generally recognize the five pillars of Islam. There's this concept that to attain salvation, one needs to have faith, but one also needs to do good. There is this concept of doing good. And we have to be careful here, because this is often misunderstood. Sometimes people assume that in Islam, it's all a matter of your deeds and that's it. It doesn't really matter what you believe. No, it matters what you believe, or at least it matters what you have faith in. Because faith is not the same as belief, right? And so deeds matter only insofar as, or in as much as they reflect one's faith. So you have, I mean, you could have somebody pray, two individuals praying, and in the Islamic view, or in the Muslim view, one person might be earning good deeds, and the other person might be earning bad deeds. Because this person, let's say over here, is sincere, praying to God sincerely, and this person here is showing off. You know, there's a joke that Muslims that's very popular among Muslims, where you have a man praying for a long time, and you have two people watching this person, and they say, "Wow, look at this guy! Look at this guy! That's a true Muslim right there! Look how long he's been praying!" And they're praising him, and they're praising, and the man, he looks back and says, "Oh, and by the way, I'm fasting too." So, and you know, you're not supposed to talk when you're praying. Anyway, okay, so now let's talk about the five pillars of Islam. One thing that, and I'll probably get to this when we talk about the Quran, but there are two human failings that we see throughout the Quran that are stressed in the Quran. The first is arrogance. The second is forgetfulness. And these pillars, it seems, they're intended to address these failings. So the first pillar of Islam is the declaration of faith, the shahada. Can you all say shahada? This is what makes someone a Muslim. they make this statement, أَشْهَدُ أَنْ لَا إِلَٰهِ إِلَّا اللَّهِ وَأَشْهَدُ أَنَّ مُحَمَّدًا رَسُولُ اللَّهِ. I bear witness, or I testify, that there is no God with a lowercase g, but God with a capital G, and that Muhammad is the messenger of God. And for someone, when someone converts to Islam, they'll make this statement once, and now they're a Muslim. When Muslims pray, they typically say this at the end of their prayer. They make this statement at the end of their prayer. The second pillar is prayer. And it's generally agreed upon among Sunnis and Shiites that there are 5 daily prayers. Now, these might be combined, or, you know, especially if someone's traveling or what have you, but generally 5 daily prayers. These are ritual prayers, and typically done in Arabic, even though most people don't know Arabic. But these prayers, if you look at how they, let me just demonstrate briefly what the prayer looks like. Typically, one will first look for the direction of prayer. They'll look to which city? Mecca. So in our case, believe it or not, it's not just east, it's northeast because of the curvature of the globe. It's a long story. Anyway, so you go, you face northeast. And then if you can't find it, you just pray in any direction. And you begin with Allahu Akbar, which means God is great or God is the greatest. And then you might have your hands here, or maybe down here, or maybe here, depending on your school of thought. And then you recite the opening chapter of the Quran, which you'll hear a couple weeks from now. And then maybe another chapter from the Quran. And then one bows, Allahu Akbar, God is great, again. And here one says words of praise. And so notice, I might not know a lick of Arabic, but the movements kind of speak for themselves, right? I'm bowing before God. And then I stand, and then I prostrate. Okay, I get on the ground, all the way down. Now this is Islam in a nutshell. What did we say Islam means?
Submission.
Look at this position that I'm in. This is a vulnerable position, right? I have submitted myself physically. And if I can't do it physically, I do it mentally, or I do it some other way. And then I sit up, and then I do it again. And right there, I've completed a unit of prayer. The only thing that was repeated, you'll notice, was the prostration. And if I'm praying with a group of people, I might be late for the prayer, and I join the prayer late. It's okay if I miss the recitation of the Quran part, but I have to catch the bowing and the prostrating for that unit to count. All right. And at the end of the prayer, people sit here, they sit down, and they say a prayer. They say the Shahada, the declaration of faith. And they pray for Abraham, they pray for Muhammad and his family, they pray to God to bless Muhammad and his family, as you blessed Abraham and his family. So Abraham appears in the prayer. This the way that most Muslims pray, and what they say. And at the end, one says, Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you. Okay. So that is the prayer, and usually Muslims will wash before they pray. If they can't find water, they do a symbolic wash. But the idea is that you're cleansing yourself, you're purifying yourself, you're washing away your sins. And if it's early in the morning, you're waking yourself up. And each prayer at a mosque will have a call to prayer. It'll be a call to prayer. It's called the adhan. And you'll hear, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, God is great. And then it goes on, and it mentions the declaration of faith and so on. And in that call to prayer, you hear, come to pray, hurry to prayer, hurry to prayer, hurry to success. And if it's early in the morning, prayer is better than sleeping. The ultimate guilt trip, if you continue sleeping. Okay. Then you have alms. Oh, sorry, let me just mention one more thing about prayer. The day of the week where Muslims congregate generally, practicing Muslims, is Friday. That is the day of the week. It's usually a noon service or 1 o'clock service, depending on where you are, or 1:45, okay? I have to get the times right in front of Tahsin there, former president of the Islamic Center. So Friday prayer, and it's a day where the community comes together, and you have a sermon, and then a 2-unit prayer. And by the way, in the textbook, Professor Peters is a brilliant scholar, But he gets some things right. He's a little off on some things. He says, for example, that the person giving the sermon is always sitting. And that, I mean, you know, if it's an old person, maybe, but usually they stand. Usually they stand when they give the, I mean, they might take a break and sit down, but usually they give the sermon while standing. The third pillar is alms, giving to those in need. And the amount that is sort of the base, the bare minimum is 1/40th or 2.5% of one's uninvested assets. These are used to give to those in need. Then there's fasting in the month of Ramadan when Muslims abstain, practicing Muslims who are able to, who are not traveling, etc., they abstain from eating and drinking and relations from dawn to sunset every day for 30 days, 29 or 30 days. And this is a period, this month is considered the month in which the Quran was revealed. So it's a special month. And you see more prayers than normal, more than is typical. Then finally, the pilgrimage to Mecca, the Hajj. And we have a separate lecture on the Hajj later, but I'll just say right now, Abraham figures prominently in the rituals of the Hajj. Okay, I'm looking at the clock, and I'm feeling the pressure to end, so I will end right here. Why don't we break up into groups? So I'll turn it over to Deborah. And so what we'll do at the end is I will summarize, I'll kind of float around and I'll summarize and then answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Okay. All right, so if you have got a colored dot on your name tag, you're gonna move toward the back of the room and we'll also help you get to the right group back there. If you don't have a colored dot, you can stay where you are. And James Wright is with us now. And he's going to lead this group here, so you're in the right spot. Okay? So we're going to break into groups, and we're going to be in the groups until about 8:15 or so.
So how are the discussions? Good? Okay, so what we're going to do now is I'll make some final remarks, and maybe, I don't know if we'll have a minute or two for Q&A. We'll see how that goes. I'd like to apologize to the group over here. I came at the very end. I'll try to come first thing next time. Oh, is there another group as well? Okay. Okay, two groups next time. Okay, so let me make some final remarks and then maybe see if we have time for questions. First of all, in my haste to finish my lecture, I missed two significant points. The first is regarding the five pillars of Islam. The purpose of all these, the purpose of all these is to attain God consciousness, in Arabic, taqwa. To attain God consciousness, so you pray five times a day, you fast, you perform the pilgrimage, and you give to those in need. And the purpose of this is to attain God consciousness, so that you're aware of God. It doesn't matter, you know, fasting is not about feeling hungry, or you know, it's about, again, being aware of God. That's the whole point. There are many sayings of the Prophet that indicate that if someone, gets into a fight while they're fasting, then they've really invalidated their fast. Okay. The second point, and this is a point that I picked up on as I was visiting the different group, two of the groups. So I have to visit the others next time. Was that, you know, when you look at the list of prophets I have mentioned here, the Quran mentions prophets that appear in the Bible and other prophets that don't appear in the Bible. Regarding the prophets that appear in the Bible, the Quran mentions earlier scriptures, earlier forms of revelation. It mentions an unnamed, a revelation that doesn't give it a name, but it mentions a revelation given to Abraham. It mentions the Torah given to Moses. It mentions the Psalms revealed to David. It's presented as revelation to David. And you have the gospel in the singular revealed to Jesus. Now, this is what the Quran mentions as it gives as examples of revelation. Now, you go to the local mosque, And you will see various copies of the Quran on the shelves in the prayer hall. You will not see Bibles in the prayer hall. On the flip side, you won't see Muslims burning Bibles. Okay, now why? What's going on here? Well, first of all, there is this idea that, yeah, God has revealed the Torah. God has revealed the gospel, the Psalms, etc. But what we have today, is that the original revelation that God revealed? As is presented in the reading, the common Muslim view is that Christians and Jews and others have misunderstood revelation. The majority of Muslims do believe that what we have today is not exactly the original revelation. The truth is there, but it's also mixed with things that were added on later. That's sort of the majority of Muslims would say that. That's what the widespread belief among Muslims is. Nonetheless, because of the fact that Christians and Jews are heirs to divine revelation, Jews and Christians in particular are seen as being special. They are the people of the book. And the Quran permits marriage to people of the book and sharing meals with people of the book. There are verses that are critical of the people of the book, but there are also verses that praise and speak highly of the people of the book. And in both cases, one has to look at the context and who's addressed and so on. I think we have maybe 5 minutes for Q&A. So is that about right? Okay. So why don't we open the floor? Questions? Things that were unresolved maybe? Yes? Yes. Okay. Well, the simple answer is monotheistic traditions affirm belief in one God. This is to be distinguished from polytheism, the belief in multiple gods, monolatry, and henotheism, where maybe someone will worship one God but believe in other gods. No, monotheism is you believe in one God, you have faith in one God, and presumably you worship that one God. That would be my definition. Yeah. Other questions?
So yes. Given the concept of one God,
yeah.
Do all three religions have the same idea of this God?
Okay, good question.
Get into a discussion of that in our
group. Yeah, this is a good question, and we had a great discussion with this group here. My own feeling. The question was. Do the different traditions, Abrahamic traditions, I assume, have the same concept of God? I would say that ultimately it is God still, God with a capital G, that all have in mind. They're all worshiping the same God, but they do have different conceptions of that God. I think here we have to look to the attributes of that God. The way the Quran describes God doesn't necessarily match how the Gospels describe God, or how the Hebrew Bible, or the Torah specifically, describe God. But I would suggest that there are perhaps more similarities than differences. And one thing I'll also add here is that there is a common misconception that the Islamic God, and I'm not saying you're implying this, but this is something that we hear often, is that the Islamic God is unusually wrathful or angry vis-a-vis, let's say, the Christian God. And one thing that you'll often hear is that the God of Islam has 99 names, but not one of them is love. That's something that I've heard many times. And it's actually inaccurate, very much so. First of all, the Quran does describe God as loving, al-wadud. Furthermore, every surah or chapter of the Quran begins with the statement, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, which means, in the name of God, the, and here it depends on which translation you go by, the beneficent, the merciful, the compassionate, the caring. And these terms, Ar-Rahman and Ar-Rahim, are related to the term Rahim. And if you know Hebrew, it sounds familiar. Rahim, which in Hebrew is what? Or Rahim, or? Yeah, and also, and the word Rahim is the womb of the mother, right? The womb of the mother. And that's the center of love and compassion, right? So these terms are related to that term for the womb of the mother, the center of love, the center of compassion. So in any case, I think they do vary when you look at the attributes, but I think the similarities are greater than the differences. Yeah.
Would you say it's the understanding and the perception that we have differences?
Yes, absolutely. The question is it the perceptions and the conceptions of God?
Or
understandings of God. Yeah, and of course, even within the traditions, right, even within Islam, we have very different conceptions of God. Within Christianity, same thing, obviously. You know, you have Jonathan Edwards' angry God, right? And then you have, give me somebody else on the other side, I don't know. Huh? There you go, all right? I mean, within these traditions, you have very different conceptions of God. Certainly, these in growing up as, you know, I've had teachers, Muslim teachers, who, you know, their conception of God was a very scary God, and others whose conception of God was a very loving and welcoming God. So even within these traditions, I mean, you know, it's certainly plausible that you could have a Muslim whose conception of God is closer to a Christian or a Jewish person's conception of God than maybe their, you know, compared to a fellow Muslim. Other questions? Yes?
Just a comment. The readings, I think we probably all found them fairly dense, you know, kind of difficult. But especially in the second chapter, I thought some of his wordings, they're very pregnant with meaning.
Yeah.
He just says a few things or uses a few terms, but there's a lot there, and he doesn't elaborate. For example, when he talks about on 23, the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, he uses the word attributed, that the Gospels are attributed to Matthew, Mark, Luke. In other words, you know, you work with that a little bit. We do not, I think it's a general Christian view, we do not know, it's unknowable, who wrote those Gospels. That Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John didn't write those Gospels, at least not the Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John that we think of. So there's a lot in very little that he says.
Mm-hmm. By the way, I should tell you that in the summer, Deborah and I attended a conference, the American Library Association, ALA, and we were discussing this book. And, you know, there were many people who were unhappy with the selection of this book. And what we said at this meeting was, you know, we just got to get everyone past that first book. So if you didn't enjoy the book, just know that it's brighter, it's, you know, yeah, it's better down the road, yeah.
I think the book is written for someone that already knows, you know, about these three religions. So
yeah.
Not go back to this textbook and know something about Islam, because he doesn't talk about the basics of Islam.
Right. Yeah, someone was asking, you know, he mentions another book, I think in the preface, he mentions another book he's written and how this is sort of another version of that. And there was a question, is that other book better? Actually, it's denser. So this is supposed to be the popular version. So you can only imagine how the other one is. Yeah.
Would it be possible for us to get the questions before we come back next time to help us with the roadmap?
That's a good idea, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, great suggestion.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah.
And I was wondering, does the Quran join them all together? Do they all?
Yeah. Yeah. This is, you know, what unites Sunnis and Shiites is the Quran. The hadiths, the sayings of the Prophet, and the biographies of the Prophet, there you will find significant debate, you know, differences. But the Quran is what unites them. Now, you know, historically, you might find, you know, person here or there who challenges this, but yeah, generally they accept the Quran, all 114 surahs, and I think it's about all we can really say. That's the one thing that really unites them, is the Quran. Yeah. Yes.
On page 39, Peters mentions, or he describes Islam in its early centuries as an urban civilization, and it struck me because I think in the American imagination, we think of Bedouin tribes in the desert or the Taliban in the mountains of Afghanistan, you know, and we think of the West as more urban. And so now we're at this point, I think like 2000, 2008, 2009, we crossed the threshold to being primarily urban humanities. So as the century goes on and that percentage is supposed to go up, do you see Islam kind of maybe keeping pace or even really being well suited to an urban humanity in the 21st century?
That's a good question. I don't see why not. I mean, there is a concept in the Quran of actually, you know, you're encouraged to be a part of society. The Quran prohibits monasticism, for instance. You are expected to be part of society. You're supposed to be involved in society. You marry. You're part of society. And you know, if you look at, you know, Mecca is urban. You know, Medina is urban. Now it is. Cairo is urban, and Islam seems to be, you know, taking off in these. I mean, I don't see any reason why that wouldn't be the case. Yeah, yeah.
May I ask?
No, please do. Yeah, please do.
Answering this question, the main issue with the Quran is the interpretation of the Quran.
Yes. Yeah, so in here she was saying it depends on your interpretation. I think you all heard that. It depends on the interpretation, how one interprets the Quran.
In Afghanistan,
yeah.
You see how religious leaders interpret the same text, but different ways.
Right.
That is interpreted by Syria.
Right.
Right.
Which is, I think it's very interesting because, you know, we often use the term fundamentalist. This is, you know, and the idea is that they're, you know, they're going back to the fundamentals, the original source, and there's this assumption that they're all, you know, extremely conservative. Well, actually, some of the most liberal Muslims will do the same thing. They'll go to the Quran directly. So, yeah, you do end up with very different interpretations going back to the source. Yeah.
Adding to what she was saying, I mean, even here, see, there are fundamentalists, you go south, people will be interpreting the Bible very differently.
Right. So we see different interpretations even, of course, here in America, right? Shall we do one more question? All right, who wants the last question? Yes.
Generally speaking, what struck me for the day and a half that I have in the world.
He just signed up 2 days ago, yeah.
What strikes me is it seems to be where people are going. Where the emphasis of prophecy is.
What separates the three Abrahamic traditions, or at least I should say the three oldest Abrahamic traditions, because, you know, we're not including the Baha'is and so on. But yeah, is it what separates them, their view on prophecy, is your question?
Yeah.
I think you could argue maybe. I mean, you know, certainly, just think about Jesus. I've always thought that Jesus is an interesting way of sort of looking at the differences of the three traditions. Whereas, you know, in Judaism, he's not necessarily somebody who is receiving revelation from God, or is, you know, and in the Christian context, he is the son of God, and in the Islamic context, he's simply a prophet of God. As for the concept of prophecy, I guess you could say they differ on who they consider prophets. I mean, and I shouldn't even say they, because what's they, right? But who is considered, widely considered a prophet, perhaps? Yeah, I'm kind of, I don't know, I'm maybe not answering the question. Right. Right. I could buy that. Yeah, I could buy that. Yeah. I'm tired, as you can tell. I think we'll end with that. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Question.
Oh, yeah.
For the books that are, the assignments that are coming up, are there any more readings that will be a portion of the book, or will it be the entirety? And if it's a portion, could you send that out? Because sometimes I need to get ahead in the reading.
Sure.
I'd like to know what.
Sure. So I will send out all the discussion questions for the remaining weeks, and the only book where we're not reading the entire thing is the Rumi poetry, which is the last session, and the poems that we're going to focus on are mentioned in the discussion questions, so that'll help you prepare, so it'll be in the discussion questions. You're welcome. So the next time we're meeting is on Tuesday, February 11th. That's the only Tuesday as opposed to the Thursdays, and we're going to be reading this Muhammad very short introduction. If there are any of you who are having trouble getting the books, please see me afterwards, and I'll see if I can help you with that. I will email everybody the discussion questions. Three more things. One is that please return your name tags. On your way out the door, there's a basket, and we'll give them to you again next time. The next thing is that we have a feedback survey, this blue sheet that's being passed around. I also have it in an online format, so if you prefer the online, you'll be getting an email with the online link, and you can have the same survey there. They're both anonymous, and it will just help us plan future dates in this series and then future programming at the library. So we really appreciate your feedback, either in the print or if you like to do the online form. The last thing is just on your way out or the next time you come, we've got a small display on the first floor of an artist's book that has the talks about the common roots of Hebrew and Arabic and traces some of the development of the Arabic language. And so it's related to what we've talked about today. So you might want to take a look. Okay? Thank you so much for coming. And if you have anything you need to tell me, I'll be here afterwards. Okay? Good night. Okay. Okay. Thank you so much.